Biden stands by Ireland. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mail. In common with the Irish Times, the paper leads with yesterday's meeting between the US President and the British Prime Minister in Cornwall. The Times runs with the line that the two leaders reaffirmed their commitment to the Belfast Agreement after they avoided a public confrontation over the Northern Ireland Protocol, but that the meeting was overshadowed by the news that Washington had issued a diplomatic rebuke to the British government last week over its handling of the protocol. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that Fine Gael in the Taoiseach of Radcar's Dublin West constituency used volunteers and students from Young Fine Gael branches in universities who posed as representatives of a fictitious company to carry out polling in the run-up to the general election of 2011. The paper also quotes comments made by former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern on RTÉ's Drive Time programme yesterday, in which he said that Fianna Fáil officials were wrong to say that prior to 2007, party members undertook polling while pretending to be market researchers. Also in the front of the Independent, it's reported that the Weston family may be selling Brown Thomas and Arnott's following an approach from a potential buyer who's offering to pay €4.65 billion for the Selfridge Group. Cost of essential services surged last year. That's the lead headline in the Irish Examiner. We're told that in the past year, electricity prices have increased by 9.4%. Gas prices are up 2.5%, while the cost of transport has risen 3.6%. CSO figures also show that housing, water, electricity, gas and other fuels are up a combined 5.4%, restaurants and hotels almost 3%, alcohol and tobacco just under 2%, and the cost of a haircut by 8.5%. Social Justice Ireland has warned that people on fixed incomes, such as pensioners and social welfare recipients, are hardest hit by these increases. The last-minute cancellation of the first of four Van Morrison concerts at the Europa Hotel in Belfast generates the lead story in both of today's Northern papers. The Irish News quotes DUP MP Ian Paisley, who had tickets for last night's gig, claiming that Stormont couldn't run a bath after the cancellation of the concert. The owner of the Europa Hotel, Harold Hastings, who had hoped that the gig could run as a test event, was scathing of the executive office, who informed him just hours before that the shows could not go ahead. And the Belfast Telegraph reports that Van Morrison was also critical of the decision to cancel the concerts. One gig which certainly did go ahead last night, however, was the James Vincent McMorrow pilot concert in front of an audience of 500 at the Ivy Gardens in Dublin. Pictures taken at the gig are carried on the front of today's Times, Independent, Examiner and Irish Sun. And that gig, combined with the fact that 1 million of us are now fully vaccinated and that the Euros are about to kick off, also inspires the Sun's upbeat headline, "Back in the game."
Leaders of the G7 countries gather in Cornwall today for what the British hosts have labelled a vaccine summit. They're expected to pledge 1 billion coronavirus doses to poorer countries as part of a plan to vaccinate the world by the end of next year. Other topics on the agenda for the US, UK, Canada, France, Germany, Italy and Japan include climate change and the economic recovery. It's the first face-to-face meeting between the group in more than a year. Our London correspondent Sean Whelan is there. And Sean, let's talk about vaccine rollout to poorer nations. Will these wealthy G7 want to counter accusations of the rich West being indifferent to vaccination of poorer nations?
Yes, very much so. And they also want to counteract what they would consider a bit of vaccine diplomacy in which China and Russia they would say engaged in and got very far down the road and got quite a lot of publicity out of. You will recall seeing pictures of Sputnik V vaccines being delivered from Russian aircraft with Russian flags on the side, the Sinovac vaccine delivered into South America at a time when the rich Western countries were all squabbling about vaccine supplies amongst themselves. And that is played rather badly on the diplomatic front. And so that now they're saying, look, we have now jacked up vaccine production in the rich West. We've all ordered and in many cases paid for pre-production of lots of vaccine supplies that are going to be surplus to here. What are we going to do with them? Well, the answer is they're going to donate a billion doses to the least developed countries in the world, which of course means about half a billion people can get the vaccines, but they're also going to go a bit further than that as well, particularly around vaccine production, which is something that the European Union are going to make a big deal out of. They are at a fairly advanced a stage of planning to set up vaccine-producing factories in Africa, and in particular for the BioNTech Pfizer-type mRNA, the most advanced type of vaccine manufacturing. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the boss, the founder of BioNTech, had a meeting yesterday, and they're going to unveil further plans to set up BioNTech factories actually in Africa itself. And they hope to be at the stage of at least fill and finish, as they call it, of putting vaccine into bottles and distributing it by the end of this year. But to actually manufacture, it's going to take several years to build up plants. As we know, even from trying to convert a very advanced facility in West Dublin for Pfizer into actual vaccine manufacture, it takes time. And there's also shortages, still continuing shortages, of the components that are needed for manufacturing vaccines. So it's not an easy thing. It's not a quick fix, but it is an important technology transfer. But the billion vaccine donation target is going to be passed today, okay, when pledges are made.
So a decision there from the G7. Now, you mentioned Ursula von der Leyen. She'll be attending, as will the Council President Charles Michel. This is a big deal for Boris Johnson. Pre-summit, the oxygen dominated really by the diplomatic dressing down of the UK by the US. Will he be hoping that now that the formal summit is getting underway, that Brexit and the protocol can be parked?
Oh, very much so. I mean, this has been part of the British planning, well, going back to last year, but certainly publicly briefed on at the start of this year. They very much see this G7 and also the COP26 climate change talks in Glasgow at the end of the year as a part of resetting and relaunching Britain in this post-Brexit era. That the rancor, the parliamentary craziness of 2019 in particular can be put behind it, the Brexit process implemented, and then you move on, and now it's a reset and a restart. That was the theory anyway, but obviously, as we know, the Northern Ireland Protocol is not sorted, and that has been dragging on that ambition of trying to relaunch a new type of Britain in the world, not part of the European Union, but very much part of a Western bloc. And that, again, is something that Joe Biden is very keen to do, which is to establish or re-establish leadership of the G7 countries in a world that had become very fragmented over the past 4 or 5 years, and in which you had seen an increasingly assertive China, an increasingly assertive Russia, and a lot of other countries not traditionally part of that Western bloc, if you like, becoming bigger players on the world scene and able to take advantage of the disunity in the Western side. That reunification of the global West is Joe Biden's principal objective here in foreign policy terms, and it's going to carry on into next week at the NATO summit and a meeting with EU leaders. So there's a lot of very important positioning and repositioning and re-establishment and reassertion of traditional positions here in order to face up to countries like China, like Russia, even Belarus with the downing of the Ryanair plane a couple of weeks ago. That's something that they want to have united positions on and be able to do and do more of into the future.
And just very briefly, Sean, the other issues that will be down for discussion, if not for decision.
It's foreign policy issues, such as things in Horn of Africa. Again, what do you do about China and Russia, and also trying to restart the global economy after that dreadful pandemic, the type of things that you need to do, where you're going to spend money, and a lot of that money going to be spent in climate change and measures. Again, that's part of the G7 agenda, how you deal with climate change. So those two things now starting to interlock, spending big bucks to restart the economy, but in a directed way on the saving the planet.
All right. Well, more from you throughout the day. Sean Whelan in Cornwall. Thank you.
And it seems each day this week has brought more mea culpa moments about fake polling from some of our leading politicians. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, has the latest. Paul, what did we learn yesterday?
Well, while we were on air on Morning Ireland, the Green Party announced that it had on occasion used party members to engage in polling. And so that was a party which initially had said that it didn't have, hadn't engaged in the practice at all, and then said on occasions it had, but it tried to ameliorate the situation by saying this had happened a decade ago and it wasn't something that the party would have considered now. After that, the focus shifted to Fine Gael. When the Tánaiste had been on an interview with Drive Time, he'd said the practice had discontinued in 2016 or 17 or some stage in 2014. That was further clarified that it actually was discontinued in 2016, but that the party had once again had both volunteers and paid students posing as pollsters to gather information for the party. In a statement, it was clarified by Leo Varadkar that it had stopped in 2016, that it had also taken place in his own constituency. And then they once again tried to give some reassurance to people that the practice had discontinued as it was no longer considered to be appropriate, that the surveys or the sample ballot papers had been anonymised and no names or personal data were recorded or retained. But I still think it was a highly embarrassing situation that we have Fine Gael plus Fianna Fáil plus the Green Party plus Sinn Féin all engaging in this practice.
So given, you know, that, as you say, it's now spread across several of the larger parties and the Greens as well, we've gone from a situation, have we, where there was a lot of moral censure against Sinn Féin when the story first broke, to now a lot of politicians saying politics were looser then. Was it that long ago?
Yeah. Well, this is it. I think from Fianna Fáil's point of view, we had an insight into how they operated when we had Johnny Fallon on Morning Ireland yesterday, and he was giving an insight into the practices of that party, and he was explaining how in the late 1990s he had been someone in County Longford who was brought into County Meath to engage in this particular practice, where he went to a hotel, there was a polling company there, and they said, "You're now working for us, here's a list of houses to go and go and check on," and off they went. And what Johnny Fallon was explaining was that this was something that political parties were engaging in, but by sort of the early 2000s it was believed that this wasn't particularly the right way to do things. So Fianna Fáil discontinued the practice in 2007, but Sinn Féin started in 2010 and continued until 2015. Fine Gael were doing it until 2016, and we think the Green Party has discontinued it sometime in 2010. So initially there was a sort of a direction of criticism at Sinn Féin, but that sort of fell away once it was realised that all of the parties, or not all of the parties, substantial number of the parties were actually engaging in the practice.
And there have been some internal disputes about the matter within Fianna Fáil throughout the day yesterday.
Yeah, the backbench TD Mark McSherry said he had been appalled that his own practice, that his own party had been engaged in this particular practice, and that he had written to the Commissioner Drew Harris about it. I mean, it was interesting insofar as that what we had heard yesterday was the fact that this practice was something which had been written about in a book by Johnny Fallon. So to many people, this was something which was already known. What was new was that it was the extent of it. But nonetheless, Mark McSherry wrote to the Garda Commissioner, and that he was seeking a formally request that you examine the issue across the political establishment. Now, we do know that the Data Protection Commissioner is going to be inquiring of it, and that'll be the first step rather than the Garda.
Just final question, Paul. All of this highlights, doesn't it, the need for something that's been talked about for a long time, an independent electoral commission that could enforce standards and make sure all of the parties are behaving as they should. When are we going to see that? It's in the programme for government, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that this government can point to. We've heard about an electoral commission for 20 years. There's been promises of it and indications it was going to happen, but this particular administration has advanced it. And we do know that Art O'Leary, who used to be the Secretary General to the President, is the person who's been appointed to kind of prepare the ground for this to actually happen. So this is something which will probably happen in this government's lifetime. And as you say, it's that type of organisation and entity which will be able to ensure that the politics is operating on a level that it's supposed to. But I guess what we'll have to do is wait to see the final detail of the legislation before people are going to be able to be reassured that practices like this aren't going to happen again, or if they do, that an electoral commission will be able to act.
Political correspondent Paul Cunningham, thank you.
And while the G7 leaders are meeting in Cornwall, the outgoing First Minister of Northern Ireland, Arlene Foster, will host the British-Irish Council in her native county, Fermanagh. New DUP leader Edwin Poots is also expected to attend, and it will be the first meeting between the pair since she was ousted from the leadership last month. The Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, Michelle O'Neill and Michael Gove, representing Boris Johnson, will also attend. The Scottish and Welsh First Ministers will join by Zoom. I'm joined now by Patricia McBride, columnist with the Irish News. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, May.
The meeting is happening. The DUP is engaging with the process. It's the first time in 2 years that we're having a meeting. Is that in itself a step forward? Is this a chance to reset relations north and south?
I think it's very clear after Edwin Poots meeting with the Taoiseach in the last few days that it is there is a need for those relationships to be reset. So whilst the British-Irish Council meeting today, the agenda for that primarily will be around COVID recovery across the islands, the issues that are going to be taking place and the discussions that will be taking place, you know, bilaterally and in the back rooms will need to be around creating stability at Stormont, will need to be around the dealing with the Northern Ireland Protocol so that those issues can, you know, can be smoothed over so that discussions can be had. I mean, you had the intervention yesterday of Joe Biden saying to Boris Johnson that a temporary veterinary agreement, which would do away with 80% of checks on products that are entering the north, wouldn't have any impact on a trade deal between the US and the United Kingdom. So, you know, those are positive soundings that are coming from the G7 meeting, and I think everybody who's sitting in the room today in Fermanagh will want to be looking to see what we can do to advance the issues around the protocol, which are creating instability in the north at this point.
Is there another issue that might overshadow events today? And this is the difficulties facing Edwin Poots and the DUP now, and Arlene Foster there today for a first meeting with him since, very public, cool relations between the two.
Well, it was a very public ousting and it was done in a very nasty way. So it'll be interesting to be in that room just to see the body language between the pair today, because I'm sure it'll be entirely different from what we will hear on the floor of the Assembly next week when Edwin Poots nominates his new ministerial team. The DUP is in a situation now where it needs to really focus on rebuilding the party. The most recent resignation was of Emma Little Pengelly, who acted as a special advisor to three First Ministers, Ian Paisley, Peter Robinson and Arlene Foster, as well as serving as MP for South Belfast for a number of years. And that's a very, very public move. So we can see some, you know, for her to resign in such a public manner is quite significant within the DUP. And I think that we're going to see more of the senior party backroom staff probably leave in the next number of weeks following Arlene Foster stepping down as First Minister. So the DUP really has a lot of work to do to rebuild its grassroots if it's going to hold on to its Assembly seats in advance of the next election next year.
Would you expect as well, Patricia, a clear indication today from Sinn Féin about its intentions next week? Because Paul Given will be nominated as First Minister. Will Sinn Féin participate and nominate a Deputy First Minister?
I think they will. I don't think Sinn Féin will allow itself to be put into a position where they can't support the institutions of the executive. Whilst, you know, the Assembly was collapsed in 2016 by Sinn Féin. It was as a result of actions of the DUP at that time, the RHI scandal. And I don't think that Sinn Féin will allow itself to be put in that position again, where the actions of the DUP force it to not cooperate with the institutions. So I think they'll be thinking very carefully about that.
And we know, Patricia, ahead of that, there was a meeting between Edwin Poots and Mary Lou MacDonald earlier this week. So will Sinn Féin have extracted, or will they want to extract, certain guarantees, particularly around the Irish language and full implementation of the New Decade, New Approach document?
Well, Edwin Pitts has said publicly that he will support Irish language legislation. It remains to be seen, you know, the exact form that that will take. But there certainly will need to be in the first, you know, first few weeks of this new administration a bit of the normal political horse trading to see where things can go, because nobody wants to be in a position. It's not in the DUP's interests to collapse the institutions at Stormont, because what they have is the promise of a vote on the protocol, you know, 3 years hence. So if the institutions aren't in place, they won't have that vote. So the horse trading will have to take place. But the big issues that need to be dealt with today are if the British-Irish Council meeting can take place and the DUP can engage with Irish government ministers on that level, then the North-South Ministerial Council needs to be those meetings need to be re-established, and the DUP needs to be participating in those as well. And that's the way to get these agreements. So I think it's positive that Edwin Pitts is coming today to take part, I suppose, in meetings outside of the British-Irish Council itself, and that those meetings have an opportunity to develop strategies for dealing with issues around the protocol.
All right. Patricia, thank you very much for joining us. Patricia McBride there, columnist with the Irish News.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
And here's Des at 24 minutes to 8.
Yeah, a lot of good news about this morning, which is nice to say in sport. Because apart from the start of the long-delayed Euro 2020 Championships, we have Irish supporters who can attend test events in the Republic today, and that's a big plus as well. And there's great news in golf as well. This young Cavan woman is going to do something serious. She's really flying. Leona Maguire is the first round leader at the LPGA Medihill Championship in California. She had 9 birdies in a magnificent round of 7 under par 65.
It's a tough golf course. You really have to hit a lot of fairways, a lot of greens. I've been playing nice as of late. Things just haven't been quite clicking, and they clicked nicely this morning. Kind of, I suppose, first arriving, it felt like home. It's a lot of the same sort of style golf course, same weather as home. So got a nice feeling straight away when we arrived on Monday.
Obviously, tremendous amateur career coming from Duke University. I mean, number one in the amateur rankings. How has the transition been to professional golf been for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, there's been a few bumps here and there. Kind of finding my feet a little bit better this year. It was nice to sort of have half a season last year, technically still my rookie year, to kind of figure it out. Symmetra Tour was a tremendous help, just getting used to professional golf, travel, and getting used to making cuts and working your way up the leaderboard. So getting sort of more comfortable every week. Was quite nice to be able to play with Sayong and Lydia today. Obviously watched them on TV for quite a while over the years, so to find myself in a pairing like that and play well is nice.
Yeah, she's flying. Seamus Power shot a 1 under par round of 70 on the opening day of the Palmetto Championship, the last event before the men's US Open. Padraig Harrington is 2 over. Wes Roche leads on 7 under. Now, back to fans attending matches in the Republic again with a few significant test events today. In rugby, Leinster can have 1,200 supporters for their final game of the season at home to the Dragons. Munster travel to Zebre. In the League of Ireland, the Premier Division champions Shamrock Rovers will have 1,000 fans at their home game against Finn Harps. The other games there see Dundalk host Waterford and Bohemians travel to Derry City. In the First Division, Cork City are allowed 600 supporters in Turner's Cross for their game with Cabinteely. The league leaders Shelburne are away to Bray Wanderers. And as the Euros kick off with Italy hosting Turkey in Rome, that game's live on RTE2, all 11 host cities will have fans in the stadia. Capacities range from 22% to 50%. That could increase as the COVID situation evolves. We'll have extensive coverage of the tournament, of course, on RTE over the next month. The Irish women's hockey team continued their chase of qualification for the World Cup. They play England in the European Championships in Amsterdam this morning. It's live on the RTE player. It's men's semi-final day at the French Open tennis. We have the eagerly awaited clash of Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic, and Stefanos Tsitsipas of Greece plays Alexander Zverev. The women's singles final will be between two players who've never reached the final of a Grand Slam event before. Barbora Krejcikova of the Czech Republic takes on Russia's Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova. Well, now to hurling, and we have set Don Log Cusack a tough task today. Predict a winner in each of the Division 1 games this weekend, the last round of the league. Let's start with Antrim versus Laois.
Yes, good morning, Des. Last round of the league, and Antrim are on 3 points in Division 1B, as are Limerick in Division 1A. A trip to play in front of the West Belfast Ultras looks like the worst ending for Cheddar Plunkett's league experience. Wexford welcomed Dublin, and the Dubs could finish second or second last, depending on how it goes here. Either way, both teams are treading water. Wexford home advantage to shade it for them. Clare versus Kilkenny in Cusick Park sees the Cats as joint league champions, unless they play the Division 1A winners in a championship game in summer. Clare always fancy themselves against Kilkenny, especially in Innes. Another home win on the cards here. On Sunday, Cork host Galway, and after the phony war their U team had with Limerick last weekend, this will be an interesting test. Galway looked like Limerick light and will offer another stern examination of the possibilities for Cork's game plan. Hopefully, the prospect of a first National Hurling League title since 1998 will see Cork go for this one, Cork to win. Tipperary travelled to Waterford and have drawn 2-1-2, but losing Bonnermaher may have the most impact for the summer. Waterford will have a similar sense of missing a limb without Ty De Burka. If Tip win, they could top the group depending on Galway's result. I expect nothing between the teams in this one. Finally, Westmead take on champions Limerick. Westmead, with a scoring difference of minus 89, play a team who just got their mojo back. It'll be a different Limerick to last weekend, but unfortunately for Westmead, not a different result. So there we have it, Des. 5 rounds of hurling, a lot of analysis, much hot air about the state of the game, and as regards the championship form from this unusual league, it's a case of round up most of the usual suspects. Unless Cork or Kilkenny make a bolt from the chasing pack, it's hard to look past Limerick, Galway and Tip.
There you have it all summed up in one go. Thanks, Don Logue. In racing, Jessica Harrington's Real Appeal won the Ballycorra Stakes at Leopardstown under Shane Foley. And we have 2 meetings this afternoon, Mary, at Clonmel and Ferry House.
Amnesty International has accused China of committing crimes against humanity in Xinjiang province. The organisation has collected new evidence of the persecution of Muslims and says the region has become a dystopian hellscape for hundreds of thousands of Muslims subjected to mass internment and torture. Xinjiang in the northwestern region is home to the Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities. Now, before we hear from Amnesty itself, we can hear the voiced and, I warn you, distressing testimony of some of the former detainees of these internment camps. This man talks about the torture of the tiger chair.
The man was in our room for more than 2 months. He was made to sit in a tiger chair. I think the man was being punished for pushing a guard. They brought the chair into our room. They told us that if we helped him, then we would sit in the chair. It was an iron chair. His arms were cuffed and chained. His legs were chained as well. His body was tied to the back of the chair. 2 cuffs were locked around his wrists and legs. A rubber thing was attached to his ribs to make the person sit up straight. He would urinate and defecate in the chair. He was in the chair for 3 nights, and he died after he was taken out of the cell.
In another testimony, let's hear this man recounting how his wife was forced to have an abortion.
My wife was 7 months pregnant. The law was, if you have more than 2 kids, then you have to pay a fine. And if you can't pay, there is prison. I told them I could pay the fine. They said no. So they took her to hospital and did an abortion.
Those testimonies voiced by colleagues in the newsroom. Now, earlier I spoke to Amnesty's senior crisis advisor, Jonathan Loeb, and he told me a little bit more about the gathering of the evidence for this report.
Over the past 20 months, Amnesty has been investigating the situation in Xinjiang, both inside and outside of the internment camps. And as part of this investigation, we interviewed over 100 people, including 55 former detainees from the internment camps. And these detainees gave us a very detailed and unfortunately tragic description of what life is like inside the camps. And each one of them describes an environment in which torture is endemic, an environment in which every moment, every aspect of their day is regimented for them. They describe a ceaseless indoctrination campaign that is focused essentially on rooting out Islamic practices and Turkic Muslim ethno-cultural practices, and replacing these with sort of state-sanctioned behaviors and practices.
How many Uyghurs and other Muslims have been detained since this particular crackdown began really in 2017?
Yeah, reports indicate that hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other members of predominantly Muslim ethnic minority groups have been unlawfully detained in Xinjiang since 2017. And according to the government's own statistics, hundreds of thousands more have also been detained in prisons. The precise numbers are unknown at this point as a result of the tremendous efforts that the government has gone to trying to prevent the world from understanding what is going on in Xinjiang.
And Jonathan, what reasons does the Chinese government give for detaining people in the camps or in the prisons? Do they say they've committed a crime against the state or a crime against the individual?
The government has provided a variety of explanations about the camps and the individuals in them since 2017, initially denying the existence of the camps and subsequently referring to them as educational facilities. But despite, again, what the government has said, the camps were not designed to educate anyone under any reasonable understanding of that term. They were designed to erase people's cultural identities. Similarly, all of the 55 former detainees who Amnesty interviewed that were in these internment camps had been detained for what appears to be, by all reasonable standards, entirely lawful conduct. No one committed any internationally recognized criminal offense. They were detained because they had traveled abroad, because they had called someone abroad, or because their family member had traveled abroad or called someone abroad. Many were detained because they downloaded WhatsApp or Skype or some other foreign software application on their phone, and many were arrested for praying or for working in a mosque or having religious content on their phone. These are the types of reasons why people are sent to these camps.
You record evidence of physical as well as psychological torture. What is the tiger chair?
Yes. Unfortunately, torture is endemic in internment camps. Every former detainee Amnesty International interviewed was tortured or subjected to other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. These are inescapable aspects of life in the internment camps. The report divides the torture that occurs in these camps into two broad categories. The first is the physical and non-physical torture that all detainees experience as a result of the cumulative effects of daily life in the camps. The second category is the physical torture that specific detainees, and Amnesty interviewed 17 or 18 former detainees who were punished during interrogations and as punishments. And these interrogations often take place in what is known as tiger chairs. Tiger chairs are steel metal chairs where a detainee's arms and legs are affixed to the chair such that they are entirely immobilized. And detainees are made oftentimes to sit in these chairs for 24 hours at a time. And often they are interrogated and otherwise physically beaten while immobilized in these chairs.
Do all detainees eventually get released from these camps, or what does one have to do to obtain your freedom?
Yeah. The process of being released from an internment camp is unfortunately not well understood, even by the detainees themselves. We do know that many detainees have been released from camps. The 55 detainees we interviewed spent, for the most part, between 9 and 18 months in one or two camps before being released. We do know that many people still remain arbitrarily detained inside Xinjiang. We also know that some people have been transferred from internment camps to prisons, and others have been transferred from internment camps to situations where they are made to do labor.
And you were listening there to Amnesty Senior Crisis Advisor Jonathan Lowe.
As part of a major shift in policy yesterday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg told employees in an email that some staff attached to the firm's Dublin office could work from outside of Ireland. They will, however, be confined to a list of 7 European countries, including the UK. But the move will have implications for employer and employee alike. Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations with IBEC, is on the line. And there are many practical considerations that arise from this from the employees' point of view, May. For example, where would they be paying tax if they availed of this option?
Good morning, Brian. You're right, it is a very complex situation for many employees and employers in terms of the consideration. And aside from just the tax issue, there are huge considerations for organisations in the first instance as to whether it actually meets the objectives of the organisational strategy and the organisational culture. As you say, there are the tax and social protection obligations, and then there's a whole myriad of employment rights issues that need to be addressed. And one of the key areas, as you mentioned, around tax, is that question of where will the employee pay tax? And it is unquestionably the case. We do have employees in other jurisdictions. You will see payroll obligations beginning to arise there, and challenges then for employers to determine who has liability, where those payroll taxes are going to be paid, and does that have a double liability potentially. Equally, you'll have the same challenge when it comes to social security issues. So typically social security is going to be paid for in the country in which the employee is working. And again, a lot of complexity and administration costs for businesses in terms of managing some of that.
And from the company's point of view, and you mentioned it there, they have certain obligations towards their employees when they're working in this jurisdiction. So do they remain in place even though the employee might be in another country?
It's a big question to some degree, Brian, because it will depend on what the circumstances of the placement in another jurisdiction may well be. So we do know that lots of organisations, if people are going to move permanently to an entity that already exists, so in, say, for instance, in multinational organisations where they will have a presence in different jurisdictions, often an employee may be what's called localised. So they'll actually move over to the terms and conditions of the local operation, and that in itself may have different contractual arrangements and agreements, potentially even different rates of pay applying for a significant move from one jurisdiction to the other on a permanent basis. If somebody were moving on a temporary basis, perhaps a secondment or a placement, as we all learn how hybrid working and remote working from abroad may work, that might have very different tax implications.
And I presume that's why they've gone for this narrow list of seven countries. If people opted to go to the UK, would that make it more complicated given that it's outside of the EU now?
I can't speak specifically for one particular company, but it may well be the reason why organisations will narrow the options for employees as to which jurisdiction they may choose to move to, because there will be all kinds of questions around the tax systems, the structures, whether they have a presence there. And depending on the state that people may wish to move to and work remotely from in the long term, there may be issues around GDPR, transfer of data and so on.
Maeve McElwee of IBEC, thank you very much.
Yesterday's meeting between Joe Biden and Boris Johnson, increases in the cost of living and anger over the cancellation of a series of Van Morrison gigs in Belfast are some of the stories carried on the front of today's papers. The Irish Daily Mail and Irish Times both lead with yesterday's meeting between the US President and the British Prime Minister. The Times runs with the line that the two leaders reaffirmed their commitment to the Belfast Agreement after they avoided a public confrontation over the Northern Ireland Protocol, but that the meeting was overshadowed by the news that Washington had issued a rebuke to the British government last week over its handling of the protocol. Biden stands by Ireland is the headline in the Mail. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that Fine Gael in the Taunus Thilly of Radcar's Dublin West constituency used volunteers and students from young Fine Gael branches in universities who posed as representatives of a fictitious company to carry out polling in the run-up to the general election of 2011. And the paper also quotes comments made by former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern on yesterday's Drive Time programme, in which he said that Fianna Fáil officials were wrong to say that prior to 2007, party members undertook polling while pretending to be market researchers. The Irish Examiner leads today with figures related to the rising cost of essential services. We're told that in the past year, electricity prices have increased by 9.4%, gas prices are up 2.5%, while the cost of transport has risen by 3.6%. CSO figures also show that housing, water, electricity, gas and other fuels are up a combined 5.4%, restaurants and hotel costs by almost 3%, alcohol and tobacco prices have risen by just under 2%, while the cost of a haircut is up by 8.5%. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Daily Mirror both lead today with the arrest of Thomas Nicky McConnell at Dublin Airport yesterday before he appeared at Tallaght District Court on a charge of killing Gareth Hutch in Dublin City Centre 5 years ago. The last-minute cancellation of the first of four Van Morrison concerts at the Europa Hotel in Belfast generates the lead story in both of today's Northern papers. The Irish News quotes DUP MP Ian Paisley, who had tickets for last night's gig, claiming that Stormont couldn't run a bath after the cancellation of the concert. And the Belfast Telegraph reports that Van Morrison was also critical of the decision to cancel the concerts. One gig which certainly did go ahead last night, however, was the James Vincent McMorrow pilot concert at the Ivy Gardens in Dublin. Pictures taken at the gig are carried on the front of today's Times, Independent, Examiner and Irish Sun. And that gig, combined with the fact that 1 million of us are now fully vaccinated and that the Euros are about to kick off, also inspires the Sun's upbeat headline, "Vac in the Game." Elsewhere this morning, The Independent reports on its front page that the Weston family may be selling Brown Thomas and Arnott's following an approach from a buyer who is offering to pay 4.65 billion euro for the Selfridge Group. There's another property-related story in the front of the Times, which reports that Dublin City Council is to sell two properties on North King Street, which it has owned since 1949, for just €35,000 after it allowed them to be taken over by squatters and unsuccessfully tried to reclaim ownership of them over the years. Also in the Times, TCD professor and dementia expert Suzanne Cahill has written a piece about the recent review of the Fair Deal scheme, which she believes achieved little or nothing. And finally, there's a nice montage of pictures on the back of today's Examiner of children from Scoil Iasach Naofa in Ballintemple in Cork who raise funds for the Irish Cancer Society by going all out with the gel and multicoloured hairspray for their aptly named Crazy Hair Day.
Any big topics on the Group of Seven summit agenda in Cornwall today? President Biden has been obviously meeting there with Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson telling the BBC this morning the alliance between the US and the UK should be known as an indestructible relation. Be that as it may, there's a lot of topics on the agenda: global vaccines, climate change. But one issue that President Biden is going to be pressing, and that's his big plan for a global minimum corporate tax rate and new rules on where taxes are raised. And this would affect some of the biggest and richest companies in the world. The planned minimum corporate tax rate of 15% increases the pressure on Ireland with our 12.5% rate, which has long been a cornerstone of successive governments' policy to attract foreign direct investment here, and which will likely cost Ireland up to €2 billion in corporate tax take. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue is with us. He was also at the G7 finance ministers meeting last weekend in his Eurogroup role, where this decision in principle on the 15% raised corporate tax rate was agreed. And it got a lot of headlines at the time. You know, we could lose €2 billion in corporate tax take. But the reality is, you said yourself, smaller countries haven't had a say. By the time this gets filtered through the G20, the OECD, maybe by the time it all shakes out in the wash in October, it won't be so bad for us.
Well, that's the work that we're actively engaged in. You very accurately described the process that is to come. There was a statement made by the larger economies, but in an organisation called the OECD, which is an organisation that has 130 countries in it, in which every country has to ultimately reach agreement on this matter in order for an agreement to be implemented. I and Ireland will be vigorously making the case for legitimate tax competition and for a rate of 12.5%.
We talk about tax competition. The French talk about tax justice. The reality is we're probably under more pressure on this within the EU, aren't we? The French will be pushing for terms and conditions on any money we'll get in post-pandemic aid for Europe, and tax could be one of them.
This has always been a very contested area within the European Union. It is worth saying, though, in terms of the funding that is now being made available, for example, for Ireland to help us deal with the consequences of the pandemic, that money is not contingent on us changing our rate. But there has indeed, in my time as Minister for Finance, been a lot of focus on our rate and on our corporate tax policy. And I've always made the case for it. It's actually what President Biden has said and what Secretary Yellen is looking to do has provided an added impetus to this on a world level. And this is why I've engaged directly with Secretary Yellen on two occasions and look forward to working with her on this matter in the months ahead.
If the rest of the world goes up to 15%, we'll have to, won't we?
Let's see what happens with the rest of the world, because as indeed you said at the start of your question earlier on, there's an awful lot to play out yet with regard to this, an awful lot.
But and the tide is against you on this one at this stage.
Well, you've
isn't
already
it?
Seen many other countries come out and now articulate their view regarding tax sovereignty and their concern regarding a higher rate. And amidst the process that is ahead and the negotiation that is yet to come, I am very confident that Ireland will continue to be a really attractive place to either grow a business in, set a business up, or to invest in. And in the work that we will do, I'm very confident we'll continue to maintain a really competitive economy and be a good place to create employment in.
That's all very well on one level, but you're left with, coming out of the pandemic, which we hope we are at this stage, you're left with massive national debt, and you're left with huge state spending, and the Fiscal Advisory Council as well pointing out the pressure on demographics. You need to raise taxes. So why are you balking at raising corporate taxes to 15% from 12.5%? It wouldn't be the end of the world.
Because I also want to maintain and grow employment. I also want Ireland to continue to be an economy, which it will be, in which investment is made, in which we have a good share of international investment. That's also been a centrepiece of how our economy has responded back to other challenges. And in our own economic forecasts that we did a number of weeks ago, it did indicate that because of the very good condition our national finances were in before we hit this pandemic, that we do have the ability to get back to a position of balance in our national finances by getting people back to work. And getting people back to work, part of that is also Ireland being a good place to invest in, which it is and will remain to be.
Yes, but we would still have, even at 15%, the UK rate is going to be somewhere in the 20s. The US rate will be similarly high. We'd be English speaking in the single market. There's no reason we couldn't be competitive and we couldn't be getting those taxes from companies that can afford to pay extra.
It's for all those reasons I'm so confident that Ireland will continue to have an economy that can grow, that can create income, that can create jobs for many of the qualities you've just touched on. We've every reason to be positive about those kind of decisions if we make the right decisions here at home. But in your question, there is an assumption in it, which is that all the other tax rates are going to go up. None of those decisions have actually been made. The United Kingdom, the US, other countries have not yet put up their corporate tax rates to the higher rates that you suggested. And what is now happening in this process is national interests are being asserted. Each finance minister is making the case for their country, and I'm doing the same.
And the world is changing post-pandemic. You have that Facebook decision to allow workers to work abroad. Is there actually, that could end up being a big threat to our FDI model, couldn't it? You look at the not just the direct taxes all those employees pay here in this country who work here, but you also look at the VAT they pay, the rent they pay, the services they employ, the flights they take. There's a huge potential economic hit right there, isn't there?
But there's huge opportunities as well amidst all of this change. Yes, of course there are challenges on the horizon. Of course, there's difficulties that we have to confront, but there's massive opportunity as well.
But we can't afford to lose that investment.
There's Irish people who may be working abroad now, who may be in a position to work at home. Huge opportunities in that. And it's not for me to comment, nor is it ever appropriate to comment on one particular company. That's a matter for the Revenue Commissioner. But our rules in relation to tax residency are crystal clear. You have to be present in Ireland for more than a certain number of days in any one tax year or in two tax years. And our rules in relation to registration for corporate tax policy is also crystal clear. And companies or workers who want to avail of the benefits of that tax residency need to meet those requirements.
Has the FDI model had its day? I mean, it's been a plank of Irish governments going back to the mid-90s. Is the world now changing? We can't rely on foreign direct investment the same way we used to. We're going to have to rely on ourselves more.
The world of FDI is changing. That is the case. The world of foreign direct investment ebbs and flows in different ways at different points in recent decades. But it's going to continue to be an indispensable part of our economic model and a part of our economic model that we're doing very well and continue to do very well in. Even in this year alone, we've seen massive companies make really big investment decisions here in Ireland that will lead to more growth here in Ireland. But alongside that, what we will continue to have is a really strong domestic economy, a domestic economy that has lots of Irish small and mid-sized companies. And many of them are now making the next step up to be more international. And many of those companies are now using the new digital model that we've all had to embrace to grow their share of exports to other parts of the world. So both really matter. And FDI and international investment will continue to be critical to Ireland. And I'm absolutely certain we'll continue to put forward a proposition that's competitive.
So if you believe we're competitive, if you believe they have, we have all those advantages, again, why resist the 15%?
Because while I am very confident about the overall competitive offering that we have, I also believe it's really important that small and medium-sized economies okay. do have the ability to use a lower rate to offset the advantages of scale, location and an industrial heritage.
Just one thing, by the way, on the property tax, and you brought in the changes recently in terms of houses that have been left out since 2013. There's a lot of calls in terms of a vacant site tax. Are you looking and will you be using the forms, the information that people return over their property tax to, if you like, scope out the potential for a vacant site tax in the budget this year? There's been some speculation about that.
It is something that I am examining. And one of the issues that we have had when we've looked at this issue in the past is that we have not had an accurate enough data set to understand genuinely what is the quantity of property that is completely unused. And at the very least, what the local property tax changes will allow us to do is to get that data. But regardless of that, I am always looking at what tax options are available to me to make more efficient use of land.
So you are looking, with that data, you will be considering a vacant site tax in the budget?
Well, just to be very precise about it, the data that you're referring to, we won't have collected before the budget. So the information will be available for input when the legislation is passed. So that information could well form future policy choices, but I won't have it in time for this year's budget.
And then on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which we've been hearing a lot, and of course we had that extraordinary intervention that day, Marsh, from Washington over inflaming relations over the protocol. Is there any sign that Boris Johnson has listened to Washington and their heavy hint that would you do an SPS deal which would deal with 85% of the checks, just do that deal?
Well, I believe in an interview that Prime Minister Johnson has given in the aftermath of his meeting with President Biden, he's recommitted to trying to find a way to resolve this. And inside the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is a way of managing the disruption that Brexit has caused, there are flexibilities and abilities within it with regard to agricultural checks that will massively reduce the number of tests and administration that needs to be done. I hope that can form the basis for an agreement. And despite the challenges that we have there at the moment, I do believe we will get an agreement.
Finally, on the fake polling controversy, it's not a good look, is it, to be finger wagging at Sinn Féin in the early part of the week when it turns out your party, in fact, even the leader of your party, has been doing something similar up to 2016?
Well, we did acknowledge when this issue initially developed that we have changed our practices now since 2016, that it had happened on a sporadic basis before that. We accept that wasn't appropriate and we stopped it.
Was it hypocritical?
But when we were discussing this matter earlier on in the week, we did say that it had happened on an occasional basis up to a point in time, and we have stopped it. And any information that's ever collected, even now by our party, is never centrally stored.
And engage in it yourself?
In my own constituency, we have on occasion done polling. And when we've done polling and people have polled on my behalf, we said we've been doing this for political purposes and they've asked.
But you didn't say you were Fine Gael, did you?
No, if asked, we'd say we're doing it on behalf of Fine Gael.
When are we going to see the Electoral Commission that could put a stop to this and make parties live up to the kind of standards they say they want to espouse?
Well, we do want to meet those standards, and we have so many things in place in relation to standards and public life that politicians do adhere to that my party take very seriously. And we acknowledge, as I said, Áine, that what happened then wasn't appropriate and it has stopped. We do have a commitment to set up an electoral commission, and Minister Darragh O'Brien is committed to doing it, and I'm sure he'll bring forward the timing for that and lay that out.
Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue, thank you very much
indeed for
joining us.
Changes have been made to the summer lifeguard schedule at Lahinch Beach in response to pleas by local surfers to Clare County Council. On Sunday, the 30th of May, 8 of the 20 members of the Lahinch Surf Rescue assisted over 40 people who got into difficulty in the water. Eilidh Sheehy has this report from Lahinch.
OK, Ryan, do you want to flip this over and see the sandcastle?
Yeah.
Okay, one, two, three, go. Sandcastle number four.
Ryan Hicks from County Cavan enjoying his staycation in Lahinch with his parents Aisling and Mark. The popular beach is a hive of activity and lifeguards have been busy on patrol since last Saturday. Unfortunately for Barbara Jordan's daughter Robin and her three friends, who had a close encounter with a rip current in Lahinch 3 weeks ago, no lifeguards were on duty and they were lucky to be rescued by surfers who happened to be there at the time.
Very, very scary. I trained as a lifeguard, worked as a swimming instructor, still swim open water myself, but it was out of my control. And, you know, it was very, very scary. And for the girls themselves, they were very panicked coming out of the water.
And was there any lifeguard on duty at the time?
So in May, there's no lifeguards on duty. The lifeguards come on weekend duty in June. Thankfully, that has now been changed. But it would be nice to see that that was extended to late September. And it would be nice to think that going forward, every year, that the lifeguards would be brought on duty earlier.
There's four or five surf schools in the water with the group, and they're obviously all supervised by qualified instructors and lifeguards. There's also about 25 to 30 people in swimming. There was a family going in with their bodyboards there a few minutes ago, and the lifeguards are here, whereas last week they wouldn't have been.
Ben Bennett owns Ben's Surf Clinic and Surf Shop and is also a volunteer with Lahinch Surf Rescue. He recalls what happened over a week ago before lifeguards were deployed by Clare County Council to patrol the beach.
The Sunday before the bank holiday, we did a huge amount of rescues. There was actually four owners of surf schools all in the water and they weren't working. They were doing rescues. And the guys just felt like they couldn't actually get out of the water because there were so many rescues going on that they just needed to stay to make sure everybody left the beach safe and happy. Myself and another member of the group put it up on social media and we got a huge reaction that there had been no lifeguards on the beach. And the word got out. So very quickly the County Council re-looked at the situation and committed to having full-time lifeguards on the beach for the whole of June.
Last year, lifeguards patrolled Lahinch Beach on a weekend basis only until June 21st and 7 days a week from the 25th of June until the end of August, as well as the first two weekends in September. This year, however, they will work on a full-time basis until the end of August, and they will also be on patrol again this year for the first two weekends in September. While this is welcome news for Ben and other volunteers, he feels it doesn't go far enough.
We would like to see lifeguards on the beach from every weekend in May and definitely September and then full time for June, July and August.
However, Cyril Feeney, senior engineer in Water Services and the Environment Section in Clare County Council, says an extra 15 lifeguards have been deployed to beaches in the county in the last 2 years and all relevant resources to cope with the demand have been put in place.
If we looked at 2019, we would have employed 35 lifeguards. That increased last year as a result of, I suppose, the pandemic and people staycationing, and we employed 44. And this year we have 50 lifeguards across our beaches. So we are definitely seeing an increase in visitors to towns like Lahinch and all our other coastal towns, and that's to be welcomed. And I think we have deployed the relevant resources, as I say.
As you see here on the beach, there is one lifeguard in the water, two up in the hut watching the whole time, and there's one down on the rocks. So they are always keeping an eye out, preventing situations from actually happening.
Tara McAvoy is one of 50 lifeguards employed by the local authority. She says it's important for beachgoers to be aware of what they should look out for before entering the sea.
Check if the lifeguards are on duty. Make sure you check the weather conditions. If it's going to be stormy, the waves are going to be bigger. Flags on the beach mean that it's a swim zone. So swim between the flags to make sure the lifeguards are always looking out for you. check the tide times. Make sure you have somebody watching you if you're going into the water at all.
These people on Lahinch Beach have mixed views about taking to the water.
We're not strong swimmers. You know, the waves are quite big out there at the moment, so we'd be just very cautious about the whole thing.
If the beach is busy, I suppose I kind of take safety in that, in the sense that if other people are in there, maybe it's not going to be too dangerous.
Do you know anything about riptides or how to spot a riptide?
Not the first clue, actually, to be honest with you.
And do you know anything about undercurrents?
Same again, wouldn't have a clue.
I'd prefer swimming in a swimming pool. If I come to the beach, it's more for a leisurely walk on the sand or a quick paddle.
People on Lahinch Beach there in County Clare, ending that report from Eilidh Sheehy.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
To Des Cahill now, and news of a young Cavan woman stealing the headlines this morning, Des.
Yes, she certainly is, Mary Leona Maguire, on a weekend that has a lot of good news because we have Irish supporters going back to test events. The Euro's getting underway. But as you say, Leona Maguire, putting us all in good humour here in the sports department, she's the first round leader at the LPGA Medihill Championship in California. It was a magnificent round. She had 9 birdies and finished 7 under par 65. And she played alongside multiple tour winners and major champions Sea Young Kim and Lydia Ko. She bettered them, and playing with Lydia didn't intimidate her.
Yeah, I mean, we're both at Lechnona now, so we'll play with her from time to time. We're there practicing every day, so we've known each other a long time. So yeah, it was nice. Obviously, both of them have had great success around this golf course, so hopefully that's rubbing off a little bit on me.
Obviously, looking ahead, few months time, Solheim Cup is looming. Have you given that much thought?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I've played 2 junior Solheims, had a great time. I love match play, and it's one of those things that the better I play, the better chance I have. So just kind of have to keep doing what I'm doing and see what Beanie thinks to come after British Open.
Yeah, great start for Leona. I sense a little American twang coming into the Cavan accent there as well. Well done to her. Seamus Power shot a 1-under-70 on the opening round of the Palmetto Championship, the last event before the US Open. Paul de Carrington is 2 over. Wes Roach leads on 7-under-par. Now, back to that story, fans attending matches in the Republic again with a few significant test events today. In rugby, Leinster can have 1,200 supporters for their final game of the season at home to the Dragons at the RDS. Munster, meanwhile, travel to Zebre. In the League of Ireland, the Premier Division champions Shamrock Rovers will have 1,000 fans at their home game against Finn Harps. The other games there see Dundalk host Waterford and Bohemians travel to Derry City. In the First Division, Cork City are allowed 600 supporters into Turner's Cross for their game with Cabinteely. The league leaders Shelburne, meanwhile, are away to Bray Wanderers. And as the Euros kick off with Italy hosting Turkey in Rome, that game is live on RTE television this evening, all 11 host cities will have fans in the stadia. Capacities will range from 22% of full capacity to 50%. That could increase, of course, as the COVID situation evolves. Now, we'll have extensive coverage of the tournament on RTE over the next month. Sadly, the Republic of Ireland missed out on qualification through a penalty shootout. It would have been great if we were part of it, but we can only look on enviously now at the likes of Wales, England and Scotland, who are competing. The Scots opened their campaign against the Czech Republic, a game being relished by their coach Steve Clark.
Well, this is why we qualified. You want to be in these tournaments, you want to be under scrutiny, you want to be questioned, you want to be put under pressure. I've never been to a major tournament, so it's the first time for me. I'm sure somewhere along the way I'll make a few mistakes, but we'll learn from them, hopefully very quickly, and we'll try and get the points that's required to get out the group stages, and if we can do that, it'll be a good tournament for us.
How far away do you think you are from being ready for that Czech Republic game as you sit here now?
I'm sure the lads would wish it was tomorrow. I mean, once you're in the tournament, you just want the tournament to start, but we have a process to get there. But yeah, the sooner it comes, the better. I think everyone wants. It's been a long wait since November. We just want to get it started.
In terms of the first game, because of the nature of the setup of the tournament, how key will this be, setting the tone for Scotland? Potentially, a win could set you on your way in terms of qualifying out the group.
I think obviously a win would be massive in the first game. Anybody I've ever spoken to who's been at a tournament or worked in a tournament is always quite strong on the fact that you shouldn't lose the first game, which is, I think, if you look historically at a lot of World Cup games and Championship games, a lot of the opening matches are draws because both teams realise the value maybe of getting something out of that first game. So It might be cagey, I don't know. It might open up really quickly. But we'll certainly be playing for the 3 points. I'm sure the Czech Republic will be. And normally, in recent tournaments, 3 points can almost guarantee a place in the last 16, so that would be a great start.
Yes, Steve Clark. Now, the Irish women's hockey team continued their chase of qualification for the World Cup. They play England in the European Championships in Amsterdam this morning, and the game will be carried live on the RT Player and News Now channel. It's men's semi-final day at the French Open tennis. We have that eagerly awaited clash of Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic, and Stefanos Tsitsipas of Greece plays Alexander Zverev. The women's single final tomorrow will be between two players who have never before reached the final of a Grand Slam event. Barbora Krejcikova of the Czech Republic will play Russia's Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova. In Gaelic football, it's a hectic weekend of fixtures. Virtually every game will decide a title, promotion or relegation. Sadly though, because we're just 2 weeks away from the championship starting, not every division will have a final, because teams playing in the championship are entitled to a free weekend in advance. But it's still an enticing prospect for Tomás.
It is, Des. Traditionally, it's a huge, huge weekend. I suppose the fact that there are semi-finals this weekend in each division for finals that may or may not take place, that just sounds bad for me. It sounds terrible. What is normally a very, very huge achievement for all these teams to win, especially in the lower divisions. It's their highlight of the year, sometimes the decade, actually. And with respect to all matches, there's the story of the weekend, Des, will be in the promotion, the relegation battles. And they're huge for teams to come up. And obviously, teams don't want to go down. And I suppose on that note, the decision that there are games not in neutral venues, it has to be questioned as well. I don't think it's fair. I don't want to be negative, but man, like, it's tough on teams. But on the positive side is you're going to have matches that teams will go hammer and tongs for. They have to. In Division 1, you have Armagh versus Roscommon, Galway versus Monaghan. Losers relegated to Division 2. There'll be a championship feel to this. I'll go for Armagh and hesitantly Galway. You go to Division 2 for promotion. Clare and Mayo go head-to-head, Meath and Kildare. They're all trying to get into Division 1. I'd love to see Clare up. I really would. But Mayo is going to be a big ask. They're going okay. I do think Meath didn't do themselves just last year. I think they're going along nicely, as are Kildare. But I'm going to go for Meath and Mayo there. In Division 2, we've got a relegation battle. Cork, who've just come up, and Westmeath. And you have Down versus Leash. This is a big one, Des. Westmeath could surprise us all, but I'm going to go for Down and Cork. I don't think Leash's confidence is good at the moment, so I'm going to go for Down and Cork there. In Division 3, all important to get up for next year's championship. This is massive for the four teams involved. You've Offaly versus Fermanagh, you've Derry versus Limerick. Offaly and Derry have been brilliant, 100% record. Will Offaly be ready for Fermanagh's defensive kind of a game? Are they cute enough to get through there? It'd be huge for them to get up to Division 2. Limerick, I've admired them, but I'm going to go for Derry and Offaly. I think Shane McGuigan, Conor Glass, McGinnis at centre-back, excellent for Derry. So there's an awful amount of other games. Cavan go head-to-head with Wicklow, Tipperary versus Longford. If Cavan and Tip lose, there's, as provincial champions, they could be down to Division 4. I'm not sure that'll happen. I think Cavan will win. And Tipperary will have a tough battle there. You have Kerry versus Tyrone in Division 1. You have Dublin versus Donegal. I hope for all our benefits that they go full on. I think they should. I think they don't have enough time between league and championship not to. And for all the negatives that I mentioned, Des, at the start of the bulletin, we have another feast of football. You know, this might be as good as it gets for some of the teams this weekend for the rest of the year. So enjoy it.
All right, we will enjoy it. Thanks to most. Extensive coverage on Saturday Sport tomorrow and Sunday Sport. Finally, only in racing, Jessica Harrington's 6-1 shot Real Appeal won the Ballycora Stakes at Leopardstown under Shane Foley. And we have two meetings this afternoon at Clonmel and Ferry House.
The coronavirus pandemic has led to a significant and irreversible deterioration in the condition of many people living with dementia. That's according to the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, which will publish new research today on the impact of COVID-19. They also say some family carers have reached breaking point. Aisling Harmon has been a full-time carer for her mother throughout the pandemic, and our reporter Una Kelly spoke to her last night. She asked her what the experience had been like.
My mum had a dramatically accelerated decline in her physical and cognitive well-being, and that's not recoverable. And for a dementia patient and for somebody with Parkinson's, it was really catastrophic to have a rapid deterioration in both conditions. So that's really quite depressing and quite upsetting. Secondly, I suppose as a family carer, it really reinforced the sense of how extreme the daily life of a family carer is and how we live on our resilience and our coping skills without contingency resources. We're an invisible front line and we had to rise to the challenge because there was no other option there for our loved ones or for the people we care for. But it came at a high price, not just for the people we care for, but also for the family carer.
Aisling Harman there speaking to Una Kelly. Pat McLaughlin is CEO of the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. Pat, good morning. Pat,
good morning, Mary.
That experience recounted there by Aisling, is that experience repeated up and down the country, that speedier deterioration in the condition of those living with dementia and the burden that carers have been carrying?
It is very much what comes out of the survey, Mary, and it's probably not unexpected given that for the past 15 months all of the day-to-day face-to-face services outside of the home have been closed. So while other services opened up maybe during the summer, we weren't able to open any of the 48 daycare centres which closed in mid-March 2020.
And now what is happening? Are those daycare centres back in business? Are the memory clinics back in business? Can people get a diagnosis?
No, there has been a slowdown in the memory clinics, although they are opening up, but the day centres, there's a real difficulty with those because the majority of them were not purpose-built or designed. So it's not like opening schools or retail. In fact, less than 25% of daycare centres were actually designed. So at the moment, of that 48, we are ready to open 6 relatively soon in the next few weeks, and a maximum of 14 because 11 of them definitely need new buildings and a further 7 would need significant remedial works. The 14 that we're ready to open, we spent already 300,000 on those to make them ready, and that ranges from about 5,000 to nearly 70,000 for one of them, because there's a lot of remedial works necessary because of social distancing and because of the back to work issues. So we really do believe there's a need for a national fund now to allow us to reopen those services, and that will only bring us back to normal. But normal has been that only about 1,100 people actually get to attend a day service, and 80% of those only get to attend for 1 or 2 days a week, which is either 6 or 12 hours. So there's been a crisis in dementia care, and while the government have put a lot of money into it in the past year, much more is now going to be needed.
You talked recently to the News at One about this new drug approved by the FDA in the United States. Could it be a breakthrough or a game changer?
I think it would be too early to say that it's a game changer. We believe that its potential is relatively modest at the moment, and that it will relate to a small number of people with mild cognitive decline. It's not likely to reach Ireland, we believe, until 2022. It's with the EMA for approval. So the planning, though, has started. In fairness, the HSE has established a group that's looking at the additional imaging capacity that's going to be needed if people do come forward for a diagnosis. But we would hope that its benefit will be that it's now disease-modifying behaviours that it's dealing with, and that rather than the symptomatic treatments that we've had in the past, may open the way to a lot more developments in drug therapy.
All right, Pat McLaughlin, CEO of the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. Thank you. More detail on that research later today.
And of course, last night saw the first live gig in Dublin since the pandemic began, held at the Ivy Gardens in Dublin. Our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley was there. You lucky thing, Sinead. What was it like?
You did feel lucky to be there. It was lovely. Now, it was very different. The big difference was that when you got there, you had to stay in what they call the pod, which was literally the people you came with. So that was up to 4 people. So I think that was what really stood out to me. Usually at a concert, you might be wandering around or meeting other people, you know, but you had to stay with the people you came with and dance and do whatever you did in that little group. But other than that, it was just fantastic to see live music, to see people working at a gig. And the atmosphere was really engaging, and you could tell people were really willing to work with the officials and willing to work with even the restrictions that were there, because they were so happy to be out and listening to music again. And certainly when I spoke to people afterwards, they said, yeah, it was just really worth it. Despite all the changes, it was worth it just to hear music again.
I thought it was absolutely amazing, just fantastic. James is just incredible, fantastic venue and great one for the National Concert Hall.
Nice to hear a bit of live music again.
Absolutely, it's incredible. And do a dance. I think the pods are fantastic.
Yeah, sure. Look, it's you have to reset your expectations. So it was brilliant. Like it was good to be there and be the first people there. But yeah, it was different. Like, but it was class. Brilliant. Like it's good to see a bit of normality coming back.
No, it was special. Very, very special. Nice to feel it again.
Did you miss live music?
Absolutely. It just was weird. It was kind of not too crammed. It was just nice and content to feel the music again. I don't know. It's really weird, but yeah.
Wonderful. Really wonderful. Yeah. It's a special moment to be back. Back in a field with people listening to wonderful music. Yeah.
Did you miss live music?
Absolutely. Every day.
Yeah, he was very emotional.
Oh, I loved it. It was amazing. So brilliant to be a part of the first concert back.
You can just hear how much it meant to people there, Sinead. And even experienced musicians in the audience, even they were, you know, incredibly emotional about it, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, spoke to a lot of gig goers afterwards, and we actually bumped into Mark Prendergast from Codaline as well. I'd kind of like to say that I used my extensive network of contacts to meet him, but actually we just bumped into him on the way out. But he was also in great form, and as a musician just felt it was really interesting to see how it all went. And he said he's really dying to get out on the road now after that.
I thought it was amazing.
Excellent. Would you be playing yourself hopefully fairly soon?
Yeah, if like I was just very kind of jealous to watch him play. It was kind of amazing to see a live gig.
Yeah,
nice to see people at ease as well.
Are you hoping to play again? Yeah, fairly soon.
We've announced a tour for October. Like it's kind of like a stripped back, lower capacity tour around Ireland, kind of acoustic.
Fantastic.
So it's like 70% capacity. So we're kind of crossing our fingers, but yeah, I mean, like it's going on sale tomorrow. So I mean, it's looking good. You know,
great.
Fingers crossed.
So you're learning from what you saw tonight.
I was taking notes the whole way through it, yeah. But like hopefully this is the first of like you said, just a summer of this stuff, you know.
Mark Prendergast from Codaline talking to our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley and expressing the hopes of many there as he left the James Vincent McMorrow concert.